Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Somalia fires security chiefs after an attack on the presidential home, and President Obama urges calm in Afghanistan's presidential election. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. The Somali government has fired its police and intelligence chiefs following the attack on the presidential palace by the militant group Al-Shabaab. The prime minister dismissed the chief of police and the national intelligence chief today, less than a day after Al-Shabaab fighters detonated a bomb outside the palace and tried to shoot their way inside. The president, Somali Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud, was elsewhere at the time of the attack and was unharmed. Somalia's information minister says there were four attackers, three of whom were killed by security forces, while a driver was wounded and taken into government custody. In televised remarks following the attack, the president denied that he had run away from the palace. He said he is in his residence, which he described as safe and secure. U.S. President Barack Obama has called the two candidates in Afghanistan's disputed presidential runoff election to ask them to let the process for investigating fraud claims go forward. In those phone calls, Mr. Obama warned Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani that violence or taking extra constitutional measures will result in the end of U.S. assistance to the war-torn country. Secretary of State John Kerry is to visit Kabul on Friday in an effort to resolve allegations of fraud in the June 14th runoff election. Meanwhile, a new United Nations report finds a record number of civilians has been killed and injured in Afghanistan in the first half of this year. The report is by the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan in coordination with the UN High Office, the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The report attributes the worsening situation for civilians to the changing nature of conflict in Afghanistan. It says ground combat among the warring parties has now surpassed improvised explosive devices as the leading cause of conflict-related death and injury to Afghan civilians. It says ground engagements and crossfire are hitting children and women with unprecedented force. Spokeswoman for the UN Human Rights Office, Cecile Puyi, tells VOA the impact of ground combat on the Afghan civilian population is devastating. In the first 6 months of the year, the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan documents 4,853 civilian casualties, including 1,564 civilian deaths. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Israel has escalated attacks on the Gaza Strip in the second day of a major offensive. At least 37 Palestinians have been killed. Robert Berger has details for VOA from Jerusalem.
Explosions rocked Gaza as Israel launched more than 200 airstrikes against the ruling Islamic militant group Hamas and other armed Palestinian factions. The Israeli military said targets include the homes of Hamas leaders, smuggling tunnels, and weapons depots. There have been more than 400 airstrikes since the offensive began on Tuesday, aimed at stopping a wave of Palestinian rocket attacks. Israel's Strategic Affairs Minister Yuval Steinitz says there is much more to come. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Indonesia was headed for a possible political standoff today after both candidates claimed victory in the country's tightly contested presidential election with more than 80% of the votes counted. Unofficial results from the Wednesday poll indicate that Jakarta Governor Joko Widodo leads by 5 percentage points over the ex-army general Prabowo Subianto. The tightly contested election represented a stark choice for the 190 million eligible voters in Indonesia. Typhoon Niaguri is taking aim at Japan's most populous areas after dumping torrential rains on the southern islands of Okinawa. Two people were killed and at least 28 injured as the storm moved across Okinawa today, leaving 52,000 homes without power. In World Cup semifinal action, Argentina is battling the Netherlands for a spot in the championship game and the Cup's first semifinal matchup today in Tuesday in Belo. Germany was one of the most breathtaking display of offensive firepower in tournament history. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
Rodan Yakuan Matok stands in a hot tent on the UN compound in Bentiu. Tens of thousands of people have sought refuge here since January. Like the people in front of her in the queue, she is waiting for food. A slogan on her black t-shirt says, I love S.Sudan.
That's reporter Benno Muchler describing the mood of people in South Sudan as the country observes its third independence today. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, an analyst says that in the long term, South Sudan needs a new constitution and a workable system of governance. A look at the history of Boko Haram, and a pair of activists continue to protest poor governance in Uganda. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Somalia, and our feature reports. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Well, 3 years since it won independence, South Sudan is struggling. VOA East Africa correspondent Gabe Joslow looks at how an ongoing political struggle, inter-ethnic fighting, and a deepening humanitarian crisis have pushed the world's youngest nation into chaos.
South Sudan's independence on July 9, 2011, was a celebration of peace. A hard-won divorce from the Republic of Sudan marked the end of one of Africa's longest-running civil wars and a victory for a long-oppressed population of the South. The country was welcomed into the arms of the international community with goodwill and the promise of partnership. But today, the country is in upheaval. The numbers tell the story. More than 10,000 people have been killed since a political dispute between President Salva Kiir and his former deputy Riek Machar erupted into violence on December 15th. About 1.5 million have been displaced from their homes by the conflict, and three separate ceasefire deals between the two sides were violated almost immediately after being signed. Julia Duani fled fighting in southern Sudan in the 1980s, settling with her family in the United States. While she visited her home country often during that time, she decided to move back permanently after the Comprehensive Peace Agreement was signed with Khartoum in 2005, and now works for an organization providing leadership training for women. She says the new conflict has brought back old memories of grief, loss, and despair.
Were we joking when we were celebrating 3 years ago, and now we are back, we ourselves killing each other, not somebody else.
Government forces loyal to President Kiir have been battling rebel forces and military factions aligned with Machar, with the fighting located mostly in the areas of Jonglei, Upper Nile, and Unity States. Populations huddled for safety at United Nations bases across the country have come under attack in ethnically motivated violence, while aid agencies say hospitals have also come under assault, with some patients shot in their beds. Peace talks being held in neighboring Ethiopia have stalled, but Information Minister Michael Makwe-Lueth says he is still hopeful that an agreed-to transitional government will be formed in the coming months, putting peace within reach.
Definitely, with the third anniversary, we are optimistic that we will reach peace in this coming period and before the end of this year.
A man-made humanitarian crisis continues to loom large in the country. Mass displacement has forced many South Sudanese to miss the planting season. The U.S.-funded Famine Early Warning System has raised alarms about food insecurity in the country, reporting that nearly one-third of the population is already in crisis, a situation that is likely to worsen. In a phone call with reporters, Noah Gottschalk, senior policy advisor for the aid organization Oxfam America, said the conflict is limiting access to those who need it the most.
South Sudan already had poor infrastructure, and now that the rains have started, a lot of roads are inaccessible. Airplanes are needed and helicopters to reach many different areas, but access is also cut off because of ongoing fighting, because of restrictions from the parties to the conflict on the movement of humanitarian vehicles.
But all hope is not lost. While many South Sudanese feel their leaders have failed them, a sense of patriotism and national pride remains strong. Julia Duani says she still believes in the dreams of an independent South Sudan that many, including her husband, had fought so hard for.
What has happened has put us back to square one, but I think we can pick up ourselves. If we have the right vision, we have the right leadership, we can carry people along so that we can gain back our momentum that we lost December 15.
From displacement to famine to never-ending conflict, South Sudan faces many obstacles in the months and years to come to realize the promises of freedom. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Thank you, Gabe. Well, South Sudan is observing its third independence anniversary today in a somber mood as the nation also marks nearly 7 months of political division and conflict. At least 10,000 people have died since December and more than 1.5 million have been displaced. Last month, both the government and rebel leaders committed themselves to form an interim government, but it's already their third attempt this year. Benno Muchler recently traveled throughout South Sudan and found that the people still believe in their country, if not their warring politicians.
The stench of corpses is almost unbearable. The floor is still covered with the clothes of the dead. On April 15th, rebel fighters killed several hundred civilians in a mosque in Bentiu, the regional capital and oil hub of Northern Unity State. The dead have been buried in mass graves. Bentiu is now back in the hands of the government, but the situation remains tense. Bentiu's public buildings and aid agency compounds have been looted. Here in the offices of Red Cross, the floor is peppered with sheets of paper and broken glass crunches underfoot. Residents have deserted their homes, and moving around is only possible in an armed United Nations convoy. A pickup truck parks in front of a gas station. A dozen child soldiers sit in the back, wielding machine guns. One of them, a chubby-cheeked boy who does not seem older than 12, is too short for his green uniform. The boys do not want to talk. Neither do the country's leaders, who in December caused the world's newest country to turn on itself. The former vice president took up arms against the president, who accused him of trying to seize power in a coup d'etat. Since then, the country's two largest ethnic groups fight with each other, the Dinka, who largely rally behind President Salva Kiir, and the Nuer behind opposition leader Riek Machar. Despite ongoing negotiations about an interim government, much of the country remains in the grip of tribal violence, hunger, and disease. People are exhausted, angry, but somehow still optimistic that they can still realize the dream of building their nation. Rodan Yakuan Matok stands in a hot tent on the UN compound in Bentiu. Tens of thousands of people have sought refuge here since January. Like the people in front of her in the queue, she is waiting for food. A slogan on her black t-shirt says, "I love S.Sudan." She says the only thing she wants now is peace. Next to her stands 24-year-old Samuel Matut Pop.
I'm still proud. I'm South Sudan. Yes, I'm still South Sudan. I will never go to another country.
Murley community, who have also come from Jongole State.
Here in the south, in the city of Nimule, on the border with Uganda, the atmosphere is more hopeful. The lush green region declared itself neutral early in the conflict and has been peaceful so far. It's neither dominated by the Nuer nor the Dinka. Joseph, who only gives one name and plays cards with friends in the shade of a tree, says his community could be an example.
We love people, we are hospitable, so we need this kind of lifestyle to be also adopted in such communities so that we are able to help South Sudan, which is good for everyone.
Eschewing tribalism seems to be a growing trend among the younger generation. More than half of South Sudan's 11 million people are under the age of 24, and many had never been to South Sudan prior to independence. They have hope, and may be the hope, for this country. Many are better educated than their parents. In cities, a growing number of young men of the Dinka and Nuer are refusing tribal markings. When he was 16, William Bolgat Kwat, a Nuer in Bentiu, told his father that marks are outdated in a unified nation.
But now, currently, all these things they has been omitted. This is a modern world. So, I think many people live about the traditional issues.
At sunset in the capital, Juba, Paul Almas, a motorbike taxi driver, waits for customers. He was born and raised in Khartoum, the capital of Sudan, which South Sudan fought for decades for its independence.
Like you see now in South Sudan, there is no law to change this. Hope to change this.
Almas came back in 2011 to help build his country through the rule of law. He hopes to make enough money to become a lawyer someday. It is one of thousands of hopes waiting to be realized in South Sudan. Benno Müchler for VOA News, Juba.
The oil-rich country finds itself at war between supporters of President Salva Kiir and his former vice president Riek Machar. Peace talks in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa have produced ceasefires that have failed to stick. Linda Bashai is a senior program officer at the Center for the Middle East and Africa at the U.S. Institute of Peace in Washington. She told reporter William Eagle that in the long term, the country needs a new constitution and a workable system of governance.
Incentive to solve this in a negotiated political way is going to involve some kind of constitutional process. That the Sudan, South Sudan, currently is in need of a new constitution. It had an interrupted and patchy kind of process before the violence broke out. It will need an inclusive constitutional process, and not one written by elites in a closed room and then presented. It will need a process that addresses the needs of everyone in the country, and it will also require a kind of government structure that begins to put in practice ideas of multiple parties and fair representation for everyone in the country. It's an interesting thing to note that the latest topic of discussion in South Sudan appears to be federalism, except that unlike how we understand it in this country, federalism is in South Sudan becoming a kind of a touch word for whether or not you're loyal to the president. There seems to be a misuse of the term. Instead of understanding it as an equitable, fair devolution of power so that the states have control over local issues and the federal government maintains control over national issues, you know, in a well-structured system and an important power-sharing mechanism, it's seen or is being misunderstood by some, not by all, as a reference to taking power away from the central government and giving it to local regions, so almost like a breakup of the country.
And in that view, the central government would have little or no power at all?
Well, I think that's the misunderstanding, that the president is promoting or seems to believe that those who are calling for federalism have this in mind. There are discussions by those trying to clarify that that's not what federalism means, and so it's kind of a struggle for the meaning of the term at the moment and definitions, and trying to say, look, federalism can be a very effective mechanism for governance, and it's very important for South Sudan to have a more clear definition of the powers. It's worth noting that currently the president of the country can dismiss governors, duly elected governors, and can even appoint governors to replace those he's dismissed. So there's quite a lot of power over the affairs of states in the current setup. But it's also worth noting that in practical terms, control over security, police, general affairs is actually de facto in the hands of many of the governors. Many of the governors are very strong and have, you know, essentially private armies. And so in practical terms, you can even see how quickly and easily the country broke apart, how unable the central government was to control the breakaway, because there is this sense of loyalty to local leader as opposed to the central government. And that's something, in fact, that federalism might improve for the central government. But I think that the president is currently against the concept of federalism largely because it's being promoted by his opponent, by Riek Machar.
I would think that one argument for or against federalism would depend on who controlled natural resources, and oil is such an important one. And yet, in federal systems, including the United States, the central government does have control over revenue sharing, over the revenues from petrol. Is that a factor as well?
At the moment, the central government takes all of the oil wealth, controls the oil sector very, very tightly. And so, indeed, it would be a great opportunity to say we're going to, you know, those states that are in fact the holders of the oil, where the oil is produced, are going to get, you know, important amounts of development because of this. But also that revenue needs to come to the center so that some of that wealth can be shared throughout the country, which desperately needs it pretty much everywhere, to be honest. It is workable. It's currently not how the revenues are calculated. You have to remember, again, that South Sudan is a country where income tax is widely unknown and unworkable. There's not a great flourishing economy except for oil. It has great potential. It has many natural resources besides oil, many agricultural resources, mineral wealth, and even odd as this sounds now, the potential for great tourism because it has fantastic games, game reserves, which are now being disrupted by the violence.
That was Linda Bashai of the U.S. Institute for Peace in Washington. She was speaking with reporter William Eagle. Twenty-one minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Well, after 5 years of what is called Nigeria's Islamist insurgency, some analysts say the conflict with militant group Boko Haram is no longer about any recognizable ideology, as the majority of victims are Muslims. Heather Murdoch looks back at Boko Haram's beginning and how it morphed from a religious sect into a violent movement.
More than 12 years ago, in northeastern Nigeria, a group of fundamentalist Muslims, led by a man named Muhammad Yusuf, quietly formed. Yusuf told followers that in order to live pure, godly lives, they should reject all things Western, especially education. Some locals thought the group was a bit odd and nicknamed them Boko Haram, which roughly means Western education is sin. Years later, security forces began investigating the group after reports they were arming themselves and tensions were high. This is Yusuf being interrogated by police in a YouTube video in 2009. In July that same year, Yusuf was killed while in police custody. This video shows his body mangled and torn. Clashes between security forces and sect members erupted, killing hundreds of people that year. A year later, Boko Haram reemerged, heavily armed. Since then, the carnage has been relentless, with thousands of people killed this year alone. Hundreds of teenage girls have been held captive for nearly 3 months now, and hundreds of other school children have been murdered in their beds. The spokesman for the Supreme Council of Sharia in Nigeria, Sheikh Abdullahi Bayero, says the violence has nothing to do with Islamism, which is the belief that Islam is the best political system.
The people called Boko Haram, they claim to be fighting for the cause of Islam, and at the same time picking arms to kill Muslims. And what did he call that? Agitating to wanted to have a Islamic state, or rather a Islamic nation. And you can imagine picking arms, killing the Muslims. Who will they rule after killing the Muslims?
Other religious leaders disagree, saying the insurgency is part of a larger religious conflict. Nigeria is about half Muslim and half Christian, and while every city in the country has Muslims and Christians living together in peace, the two groups are often separated along political, geographical, and tribal lines. Violence between Muslims and Christians unrelated to Boko Haram has also killed thousands of people in the past 4 years. This is Ayo Oritsejafor, the president of the Christian Association of Nigeria.
Basically, the attack, the offensive, is against the church, is against Christianity and Christians. But right now, in the last 6 months or thereabout, they've started attacking Muslims as well.
He says Boko Haram targets Muslims that do not agree with their ideology, citing the murders of several prominent sheikhs that preached against extremism.
There are also Muslims who give out information to security agents about these people because they don't believe in it, so they give out information. They also go after those people and kill them.
Other religious leaders say Boko Haram's targets are so varied that it is impossible to tell what the group's real goals are. President of the Peace, Revival, and Reconciliation Foundation of Nigeria, Pastor Yohana Buru.
Only those who are in Boko Haram will tell whether it's religious or not religious. Only those who are part and parcel of it that knows what they want to achieve.
Analysts say Boko Haram now appears to be capturing villages and towns and is increasingly well-armed with leaders from the northeast, a region that has been under emergency rule for more than a year, saying the group even has helicopters dropping food and arms into the forest. The group still says non-Islamic education is punishable by death, but has not explained what kind of behavior will spare people from its ruthless attacks. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Well, last month, a pair of activists sneaked two piglets into Uganda's parliament to highlight political corruption and greed. As Hillary Hewler reports for VOA from Kampala, they say their protest against poor governance is far from over.
On June 17th, two young men calling themselves the Jobless Brotherhood grabbed headlines when they snuck two piglets, painted in the ruling party's signature yellow, into the Ugandan parliament. Wearing signs saying "End Pigs," the piglets managed to get as far as the parliamentary chambers before being stopped by police. Norman Tumuhimbise and Robert Mayanja were arrested for the stunt and released several weeks later on bail. The pair has since been rearrested for illegal assembly under Uganda's Public Order Management Act. Tumuhimbise and Mayanja say they represent millions of desperate and unemployed Ugandan youth. Their rallying cry, "Don't lead us into temptation," carries a veiled threat of violence. The pigs, say Tumuhimbise, are symbols of political corruption and greed.
Besides a hyena, some other most greedy animal is a pig. When it gets hungry and greedy, it just eats its piglets. These MPs are eating us alive. We have another, those of us who read the Animal Farm. In this country, we have so many Napoleons and Snowball now, either in opposition or in government. These are national MPs that are sitting in that house.
Animal Farm was a George Orwell novel about a government exploiting its people. The piglets were confiscated as evidence. Police later claimed they were testing the animals for terrorism-related material. But Tumuhimbise says he and Mayanja want their pigs back.
These are our pigs. This is our envelope where we always package our message. These are our delivery boys. And by the way, they did us proud because they delivered the message very well. I think they deserve another term.
Corruption scandals in Uganda have proliferated under the country's longtime president, Yoweri Museveni. No official unemployment statistics exist, but a report last year by ActionAid International found 62% of Ugandan youth surveyed were jobless. Tumuhimbise and Mayanja say that despite the charges against them, their activism is far from over. Their next step, they say, will be to hold a youth convention in Kampala. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Kampala.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 1730 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
employment rates are climbing. So definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. South Sudan observes its third independence anniversary today in a somber mood, while an analyst says that in the long term, the country needs a new constitution and a workable system of governance. Coming up, we have music from Somalia and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next.
Put your flags up in the sky, in the sky.
Juggling world.
And we're on Saturday,
glad you're alive.
So the world where you're from, somewhere you're from.
We are one.
So the world we are one. Love.
Hey, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand a World Cup question kicks off your sports report today.
Kim, will it be Argentina or the Netherlands playing Germany in Sunday's World Cup football final in Brazil? We'll know the answer to that question later Wednesday evening in Sao Paulo, where Argentina plays the Dutch in an eagerly awaited semifinal that kicks off at 2000 UTC. Argentina, led by superstar Lionel Messi, has won five straight matches in the tournament as it bids for a third world title. The midfield maestro Messi has scored four of Argentina's eight goals in the competition, including two against African champion Nigeria in the group stage on June 25th. Nigeria's World Cup goalkeeper is Vincent Enyema.
This program has come to you from the Voice of America, Washington.
Well, I guess we're not going to hear from Vincent Enyema. Wait a second. I think we got him. Vincent's
He's
back.
He's one of the best players in the world. Everybody knows it. Messi's a genius. Messi is one of the greatest players footballers produced.
Good to hear you, Vincent. Always good to bring you back on to the Voice of America airwaves. Vincent Enyema, the Nigerian keeper. Meanwhile, the Netherlands has produced three runner-up performances at the World Cup, finishing second in 1974, 1978, and 2010. This is a rematch of the 1978 final, in which Argentina defeated the Netherlands 3-1 in extra time. The Dutch are coming off a 4-3 penalty kick victory over surprise package Costa Rica in the quarterfinals. During that penalty kick shootout, Dutch coach Louis van Gaal pulled off perhaps the most surprising move in a tournament filled with high drama. Tim Krul, the Dutch team's backup goalkeeper, hadn't played at all in Brazil up to that point. With penalty kicks about to settle a scoreless draw, Van Gaal took out his starting goalkeeper, Jasper Selesen, who just played 120 minutes without allowing a goal, and put in Krul. Krul then blocked two Costa Rica shots to help the Netherlands advance to the semifinals. Krul talks about Argentina and this evening's big game.
They're in the semifinal, so you have to be a fantastic team to be there. But we are a fantastic team as well, and I think we can be really confident with what we've shown, the players we've got. We're fit. I think we're fitter than most teams in this World Cup. And like I said, we can be confident, and it's going to be a fantastic game.
Tim Krul is expected to return to his backup goalkeeper role this evening against Argentina, with teammate Jasper Selesen back in goal for the Dutch. Meanwhile, Brazilian football fans continue to mourn Tuesday's humiliating 7-1 loss to Germany in the World Cup semifinals. Desolation, disappointment, and disbelief swept across Brazil as the team, a big favorite to win a record-extending sixth world title, crashed out of the tournament. Brazil's head coach, Luiz Felipe Scolari, described it as a catastrophic, terrible loss. In fact, the 6-goal margin of defeat matched Brazil's worst defeat ever in a competitive match. In 1920, Brazil lost 6-0 to Uruguay in the Copa America tournament. It was also Brazil's first loss in a competitive match on home soil since 1975, when Peru beat Brazil 3-1 at the same stadium in Belo Horizonte in the Copa America competition. Brazilian newspapers described the lopsided loss as historic shame. No one expected such a dramatic and overwhelming defeat. Another Brazilian newspaper ran photos of tearful fans under the headline, "The Faces of Disappointment, Country Breaks Down in Tears with the Rout." The Germans set more than a few records in the rout. The Germans scored 5 goals in the first 29 minutes, the fastest any team has scored 5 goals in any game in World Cup history. And let's give a sunny side of sports shout-out for Miroslav Klose, who scored Germany's 2nd goal of the game. It was his 16th career World Cup goal, making him the World Cup's all-time leading scorer and breaking the mark he previously had shared with Brazil's Ronaldo. And let's give another sunny side of sports shout-out for Toni Kroos, who scored 2 goals in just 69 seconds for the Germans. It marks the fastest the same player has ever scored twice in a World Cup match. More records from Tuesday in Belo Horizonte. The 7-1 scoreline is the largest margin of victory in a FIFA World Cup semifinal. Germany's 7 goals are also the most ever scored in a World Cup semifinal. The win also allows the Germans to advance to their 8th World Cup final. Yes, a new record, beating Brazil's 7 appearances in the finals. Joining us once again this evening with our latest African football quiz question, World Cup related, is David Legg.
Who was the most successful coach of an African team at all the World Cups? Now, I stress an African team. So in other words, it can be a foreign coach or it can be an African coach. Now, what's very important is how you decide who has been the most successful. And what you do, Sonny, is you base it on percentage success. And what you do is you look at the record of each coach. Now, for example, I'm going to pick out one coach, Vidinic. He coached Morocco in 1970, and he coached what was then called Zaire in 1974. So he coached at 2 consecutive World Cups with different countries. Now, his record, Sonny, and he's obviously not the winner, and that's why I can mention him, is 6 matches played, 1 draw and 5 defeats. And unfortunately, the reason he saw his team score only 2 goals but concede 20 is, of course, Zaire were hammered 9-0 at the 1974 World Cup by the then Yugoslavia. So in other words, Sonny, he's played 6 matches. Now, in each match, you've got 3 points available for a win. So that's a total of 18 points. And he got 1 draw, so he only got 1 point. So what you do is you get that one, the 1 point, you divide it by 18, which is the potential total, and then you multiply by 100. And that's how you work out your percentage success. Because, Sonny, it's the only fair way to do it, because like you take a coach like Henri Michel of France. He's coached at 9 matches at the World Cup, and then other coaches have only coached at, say, 3. So I think this is a very fair system. So what we want to know is who has been the most successful coach of an African team at the World Cups, and that's going, Sonny, from 1934 to 2010. And I'm sure you're going to have a very good prize or prizes for the winners because they're going to sweat a bit on this one, Sonny.
Yes, David, we will have some of those delightful VOA goodies for the winners. Why don't we set a deadline, David, of July 13th, which is when the World Cup final will be played in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. David and I will now give our addresses where you can send your entries. And once again, we have a July 13th deadline for our latest African football quiz question. VOA!
It's David.leg, and leg is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France Presse, .com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's David.leg, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com.
You can send me email at sunny at voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. Voice of America, VOA,
Washington. This is the Voice of America, Washington. D.C.
Put your flags up in the sky.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit voafootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at voafootball.com.
If you were to talk to us from the deepest, better part of the bottom of your heart. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
And my Voice of America colleague, Shaka Sali, will be waiting for you later Wednesday evening at 18:30 UTC with another edition of his Straight Talk Africa program. Shaka has invited yours truly to participate in this evening's show, which will focus on the World Cup in Brazil. Another guest on Straight Talk Africa is Philip Zhao, the head coach of the men's soccer team at Howard University here in Washington. During his playing days, Philip was a striker who played professionally, and his father, Joseph, once played for Ghana's beloved national team, the Black Stars. The Black Stars, quarterfinalists at the 2010 World Cup in South Africa, did not shine as brightly in Brazil. The Ghanaians wound up with 1 point out of a possible 9 in a very tough Group G that also included Germany, Portugal, and the USA. And the Ghanaians packed their bags after the group stage. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Okay, thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, economists say a raft of proposed new taxes in Uganda unfairly targets the poor, particularly farmers. And a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador with an Ethiopian heritage. First, we have some music for you. Here's Kaskia of Somalia with Dika. Of Somalia with Dika. While Uganda's government has been struggling to find new sources of income since Western donors cut funding over the country's anti-homosexuality bill passed late last year. As Hillary Hewler reports from Kampala, economists say a raft of proposed new taxes will target the poor.
Uganda's proposed new budget, unveiled by the finance minister last week, aims to fill at least part of the shortfall left when some Western donors withdrew millions of dollars in aid earlier this year. But Ugandan economists pointed out Tuesday that many of the proposed new taxes would hurt the most vulnerable members of society. Speaking at a conference of economists in Kampala, they described these taxes as regressive. Items like salt and kerosene, which are subject to new taxes under the budget, are disproportionately used by the poor, they said. A tax on agricultural inputs also came under attack. Civil Society Budget Advocacy Group coordinator Julius Mukunda says taxing such basic supplies as garden hose unfairly targets subsistence farmers, a sizable percentage of Uganda's population. He adds this could have broader consequences.
You taxed a whole. That's how this money will come. All these ones are going to make everyone who is living in the neighborhood from agriculture to suffer. If we have been fearing food security, fearing
Okay, and we'll move on to our second feature. A young activist for girls' education is calling on the United Nations to come up with a tangible plan of action to end the discrimination that keeps girls out of school. In an interview with VOA, UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador in Ethiopia, Hannah Gadafa, reflects on the passion that drives her to speak out for the right of all girls and women to be educated.
To say that Hannah Gadafa, who was born in Canada to Ethiopian parents, is a remarkable young woman does not do justice to her list of accomplishments.
Honestly, being a UNICEF Goodwill Ambassador has been one of the greatest joys of my short 16 years of living.
She was appointed to the post in January 2013 at age 15. Since then, Gadafa has been visiting Ethiopia and other countries in sub-Saharan Africa to promote the benefits of girls' education. She tells VOA it is her job to speak out on behalf of the millions of girls around the world who do not have access to schooling.
Girls also face a lot of responsibilities that I'd say discourage them from attending school, lots of family responsibilities. There are so many cultural barriers for girls to prevent them from receiving education, and many economic factors that families have to consider when they're choosing whether to send their boys to school or whether to send their girls to school. So all the odds are stacked against them, and that's why we have to target them and support them and protect them.
Gadafa's involvement with children's education began at age 7. During a visit to relatives in rural Ethiopia, she made a good friend and wanted to keep in touch with her when she returned home. She was frustrated to learn her friend did not have pencils or paper. So she founded the Pencil Mountain Project, which she says has distributed more than 500,000 items for use in schools.
So things beyond pencils, like other basic school supplies, as well as textbooks for second generation universities, some of the newer universities that have been constructed in Ethiopia, as well as wheelchairs for students with disabilities, and a whole bunch of supplies that are under the umbrella of basic education for students. And that's for boys and girls.
Gadafa says she believes she's having an impact as Goodwill Ambassador. Coming from Canada, she says, makes her living proof of the benefits of sending a girl to school. On the other hand, she says having Ethiopian roots gives her insight into the country's traditional practices and helps her navigate around cultural mindsets that keep girls out of school. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer Bill Workinger and our engineer Alfredo Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Tensions are high between Israelis and Palestinians in the wake of the vicious killing of three kidnapped Israeli teenagers, one of whom was an American citizen, and the brutal murder of a Palestinian teen who was kidnapped and killed after the bodies of the three Israeli teens were discovered. The three Israelis were missing for 2 weeks before their bodies were found buried under rocks in a field near the city of Hebron on June 30th. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the kidnapping. Right now, there are many indications pointing to Hamas's involvement, and it is also important to note that Hamas's leadership has publicly praised the kidnappings. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the murder of the Palestinian teenager on July 2nd a despicable act. He called for a speedy investigation to find the perpetrators and urged all sides not to take the law into their own hands. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry condemned in the strongest possible terms the murder of the three Israeli teenagers, Naftali Frankel, Gilad Shar, and Eyal Yifrak, and separately the murder of the Palestinian teenager, Mohammed Hossein Abu Qadir. Calling the killing of the Israeli youths a terrorist act, Mr. Kerry said in a statement, "There are no words to express such horrific loss that shakes all people of conscience. We grieve with all the people of Israel." Knowing that Naftali was also an American citizen makes this an especially heavy blow, not just to Israel, but to the United States. The killing of innocent youths is an outrage beyond any understanding or rationale, and the perpetrators must be brought to justice. Secretary Kerry called the abduction and murder of Mohammed Hossein Abu Qadir despicable and senseless. Mr. Kerry said in a statement, "It is sickening to think of an innocent 17-year-old boy snatched off the streets and his life stolen from him and his family. There are no words to convey adequately our condolences to the Palestinian people." The world has too often learned the hard way that violence only leads to more violence, and at this tense and dangerous moment, Secretary Kerry said, all parties must do everything in their power to protect the innocent and act with reasonableness and restraint, not recrimination and retribution.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials. This program has come to you from the Voice of America, Washington.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth.
As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Put your flags up in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit voafootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet, and we'll bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at voafootball.com.